You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey, I'm Brian Hyatt, and this is Rolling Stone Music Now. Today we have kind of a special episode. The latest Rolling Stone cover story is on the Rolling Stones, band you may have heard of. I wrote it, and I spent some time with Mick Jagger, Keith Richards, and Ron Wood. We're going to play a little bit of my Mick Jagger and Keith Richards interviews today. Let's start with a bit of the conversation I had with Mick about the Stones' new album, Blue and Lonesome, which is a blues covers album. And he explained that although it sort of started spontaneously in the studio, they broke into a cover of the song Blue and Lonesome by Little Walter, Mick actually had talked to producer Don Was about the idea of doing a blues album. Here's what he had to say.
The thing was that it was funny because I've been speaking to Don Was about doing a blues album.
Oh, that I did not know.
Okay. Already. And what my idea of doing it was that it was going to be really relaxed because we do these blues tunes in rehearsal. So we go into rehearsal, and before we'd actually get down to saying, okay, let's do You Can't Always Get What You Want, you know, which we knew already, but we still got to do it. We would play blues tunes, and we played Commit a Crime, for instance, and we had played Blue and Lonesome. And I said, well, we keep playing these tunes. Maybe we should just, like, record the rehearsals a bit better.
Yeah.
And then there's no pressure. You know, there's absolutely no pressure to do, like, okay, this is the take of Blue and Lonesome. It was like, just do it. And then over the period of 2 weeks or, you know, that we have in rehearsals, we'll have a whole bunch of blues tunes. And if we do two rehearsals, then we'll have another whole bunch of blues tunes. And like that, we'll have a blues album. So I actually mentioned that to him very recently. Because we were doing, well, we'd always done blues tunes in the rehearsals, you know. But we'd been doing a few more, and we've just been, like, doing them. Anyways, so then, whatever. So then we did it in a similar sort of thing. It's like going to a blues tune to kind of, like, get into shape kind of thing. So in the middle of doing a new song, so, well, let's just leave that aside for a moment, and then we'll do Blue and Lonesome, which is what we did first. And then and we said, oh, that sounds really good. Let's do another one. We did another one, and then we did another one. And then Don Moore said to me, well, can you go home tonight and make a list of what we're going to do blues, if we're going to do more blues tomorrow, you better make a list because we, you know.
He said you have a blues iPod, one with just blues songs on it.
That's not right. I don't.
So he believes, yes.
No, I just went into my computer and went into the blues songs I had in there, which, you know, whatever. So actually, it's, I mean, I was thinking it's the most enormous library. When I looked at it, I think this is actually rather shabby. You know, it should be better. But anyway, and I went in and made a list of what I thought, you know, we'd do that day, and wrote it down and went into the studio, and I just shouted out, oh, let's do this. And if people said yes, then we did it. And if people said, oh, I don't know about that one, I said, okay, then this one, because I had enough, you know, that you want to insist, just call the tunes and see if people pick up on them.
It gave you a chance to play, like, probably the most, like, blues harp you've got to play.
Go on, it's like, I should have practiced. If I'd have known I was going to have to do this, I would have been a few days practicing, because sometimes I do that. And you know, I sit at home and play. It's quite easy, really. I mean, you just put on whatever, a whole bunch of Muddy Waters records. The only problem with harmonica playing is the keys.
Yeah, of course, you need to write.
You have to have all the keys, and you have to know, because otherwise it's really boring trying to sort through. So you have to write down, oh, this Muddy Waters tune is in, you know, C. So then I'm not going to have to look every time for this key. So you do that like an album. You know, you get like one of those Muddy Mississippi Waters. I think we've got Johnny Winter on it. Well, we produce, you know. So I sometimes like playing harmonica along. So I play harmonica along with that. And it's good practice, you know, and you get your chops together and do that a couple of hours a day for a few days. And you get at least into kind of some sort of practice.
Right.
But I should do a bit more than that, to be honest, but it's not the only thing I do. And so when I was like thrown into the deep end of being like on like almost every other tune is like, okay. And then it's all right, but you know, you hope it's going to work. And then you've got these things which have harmonica intros that go, rah, 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 boom, boom, you know, you got to get that right because you can't screw it up, you know, because it's, you know, I mean, it's like doing intro on a guitar, but if it's not an instrument you play a lot, then, you know, I'm more familiar playing guitar than I'm playing harmonica, you know, to be honest. For a long time.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I like playing harmonica. But anyway, the thing is, the really good thing about those, well, yeah, you get to play over a certain, you know, you get to keep playing it. So, you know, you get to do it. So more than just like a overdub solo, let's say. The way we'd set it up was like, we got you. The thing is, for me, I'm sure for all players on all instruments it's the same, but for harmonica is to get the sound that I want to hear on the headphones, you know.
Right.
It's all about that, because it's not really about acoustic playing harmonica, it's about putting the harmonica through, you know, amps and you know, and echo effects and overdrive compression and everything. And that's why I always say to these people, say, oh, it's just an amp, you just like knock it off. But you it's true, you do, but there's a lot, you have to make this harmonica sound right. So then you really hear it. So what's different about it to me, the sound, as a harmonica player, just as a harmonica player, is that I can, I got used to hearing all the nuances of it, because when you play on stage harmonica, you can't hear almost anything, because it's a rock band. It's like, and if, in a blues band, that blues bands normally play really quiet. So the harmonica you can play through, you know, when I go and see sometimes blues bands, they're so quiet. So the harmonica can play through amp. It doesn't feed back.
Yeah.
And you can get all these effects and you can hear perfectly what you're doing. But with a rock band, you know, they're used to playing like that. So, but in the studio, of course, it doesn't matter. So I can play through the thing and the band's not as loud as it might be on stage. So then I can hear all the nuances in the harmonica playing. So, and the bending and where the notes are going, because, you know, you don't normally hear that on stage. So I could get into, you know, how it really sounds and everything. And so harmonica's an instrument, you're not looking at the keys like you're on a piano or on the fretboard of a guitar. It's all like in your feel. So you really have to hear it a lot, especially if you don't play very much. So you have to really hear it perfectly to know if you're going to hit the right notes, especially on the bends, because it's all about the bend to get some of the notes, because there's not that many notes. So you have to bend them to get the notes. And so I was hearing it really good. So for me, that was a big plus, being able to play it. I'm sorry, that was a bit of a technical explanation.
Yeah, no. I play enough blues harp that.
Okay, I didn't know that. You should have told me. You should have told me. I was like, explain to someone that doesn't understand anything about it, saying, oh, we can't see the notes. What do you mean you can't see the notes? We like, you can't see the notes.
Well, it's got me listening to Little Walter again. It's like, I mean, you know, covering his songs is like a guitar playing. Player covering, you know,
Jimi Hendrix or something. I know, I said that to someone else. Yeah. It's like, it's, that's, yeah, I mean, it is, you know, and because he's, you know, there's a lot of technically able people out there now, as we know, that maybe you could say, well, this guy's actually technically better than Little Walter, you know, technically, you know, so this guy plays technically better than Charlie Parker. But the point is that you will know he's great and he invented this sort of style, you know, which, and a sound and a style and a kind of attitude and whatever it is. And, you know, and actually some of the licks are really hard to do, but there's also a kind of how do you say that he doesn't overplay, you know. So he kind of leaves a lot of space, and I kind of really started noticing that. I would play da 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 da. I thought, well, you don't actually probably should. It sounds good, but now I'm playing blues like. Three blues in a row. Now I'm getting to the hang of this thing that I don't have to play so much, you know. And because I'm confident. This isn't my only solo.
Yeah, you're right.
So I don't have to play, you know, I don't, like, this is it for the whole album. This is going to be only one bit. And, but as you say, like, trying to play Walter, yeah, well, I'm not, I'm obviously can't do it, but I can give a good, you know, go at giving a feeling of Little Walter, yeah, or the, or that, some of the attitude. I hope I can convey some of the attitude of that.
So, I mean, it's not, so if you were already talking to Don about this, this was less of a, perhaps an accident than it.
I think, yeah, in a way, this, yeah, fortuitous. I mean, you could, yeah, you can tell it as it's like all just suddenly happened. But I think it was all kind of waiting to happen at a certain moment, and then the moment came, you know, so that was all good.
Well, it's like the old Picasso joke, it took you 50 years to go to make this album in 3 days.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
No, exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's a sum of it. It's a sum of experience, you know, and all these songs, I'm not sure if everyone knew all these songs. It's not true. But Ronnie said, well, I never heard that one. I'm not really familiar with that one. I can't remember which one he's talking about. Hoodoo Man Blues, for instance. I don't think Ronnie was terribly familiar with that, for instance. But I still, whatever it is, it is. But most of them were stuff that we played since we were teenagers, you know, yeah, to be honest.
Okay.
I mean, and they're not the most well-known ones, but they're all on those famous albums, aren't they? You know, so it's not like My Babe by Little Walter, obviously. But nevertheless, you still know those. But maybe the stuff, yeah, that fast one, Got to Go, is a bit unfamiliar. But I remember, yeah, playing that in a rehearsal, like not playing it live, but I played the Little Walter record, I say, because it's a bit, that's a little bit unknown, that one, out of the catalogue, so to speak. And I'm not sure if anyone had heard it. And I said, I wanted to play it for Charlie, because I said, Charlie, what is the guy playing on the drums on this? I don't, yeah, get it.
Yeah.
And when we did it, we didn't try and copy the drum part, because it's something he plays on the toms or something. But so Charlie just played this sort of straight beat. But I remember playing that in a rehearsal somewhere in America, you know, really loud on the stereo.
So why, after all this time, did you want to make a blues album? Like,
I didn't want to make a blues
album. Well, except that you were talking about it with Don.
I was.
Yeah, you said that, yes.
I was. Yeah. And then I thought, okay, so this is a really natural thing. This is like an extension of, you know, we've been playing blues obviously all our lives, and now we're going to actually see how this is going to work. And it sounded really good at the beginning.
Yeah.
You know, when we played like Blue Notes, and I wish I could remember the sequence of what we did. But
yeah, Dan didn't remember either.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's all on files, because it's all the dates on the files. But I wish I should have asked the engineer what did, because I remember we did Blue Notes, but I can't remember what we did next.
Yeah.
And I might even have it on a list somewhere on my iPad. Maybe I wrote it on paper. But anyway, so yeah, we did that, and we did 2, 3. What was your question? I can't remember. Sorry.
Just the why? Why now?
Yeah, I don't know, but I don't know the answer why. I guess we were playing. We liked playing the first one, and we just sort of followed a pattern, and it was really quick. And what was good about it was that you know, doing new songs, you never quite know. You can do them any way, any beat. You know, that you've got an idea, we can go any which way, or a complete song can go. Whereas these, it's you kind of, the good thing is you've got three done, and there's a sense of, you know, achievement in the fact that you've done, oh, I did three songs, and tomorrow I'm going to do three more, and tomorrow I'm going to do three more, you know, so it's like a, you know, that feels really good, I think.
And you can factor it. So Don made it sound like there was some, because I spoke to him a couple of days ago,
yeah,
it made it sound like there was some dispute over whether you guys actually wanted to put this out, that it was a process of...
No, it wasn't a real dispute between the band or anything. The only thing I said to the record company, which is, let's face it, they're not like blues people. I mean, they're very nice people, and some of them I know really well. But do you want some?
Sure.
Careful. You never know. We made this blues album, but what are we going to do with it? Because we're in the middle of making a new album. So, is it possible you can market this? Is it marketable? Or would you like to put it? That was my question. Was it marketable as a separate album, or would you like to wait till the new album is finished and put it out with the
right?
With, so you've got well, you know, whatever. You've got like 12 new things and you've got 12 blues things, which is kind of a nice package. I mean, you know, you've got a lot of stuff suddenly, boah, you know what I mean? That would have been interesting. And I said, but mate, you think about that. You're the ones that are going to market it. Which way would you want to go? And I said, because I'm interested to see how you could possibly market this
right.
blues album. Come on. Yeah. Which traditionally is going to not interest anyone. It's very niche. I mean, there's nothing wrong with it. I mean, we're not. It's not trying to like say, well, we won't make any money. But who's going to hear it? Who's ever going to, you know, is it ever anyone going to go on Spotify and play this blues album? You know what I'm saying? So it's going to get like, no one's going to listen to it. So that to me is part of it. You know, you want to make a record, but you want people to hear it, don't you?
Of course.
Yeah, it's not supposed to be just for your family. So you know, so that's nice, Dad. But so that's what my question was to them.
Yeah.
You know.
So that was the issue, yeah. So you always wanted
to... No, it's just, it's in a way of me, okay, how are you going to market it?
Sure,
And are you going to do a good job is always my question. That's the artist's question, it has to be.
So I'm like, you know, there's a certain, after a 10-year gap between albums, I think some people...
Yeah, I didn't really think about that much.
I think some people, I mean, frankly, some people are like, oh, they're never finishing that album. The other one, I mean...
You've kind of got that, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but we haven't even tried to make one, so we haven't been doing it very long. Right. But yeah, I mean, probably the record company said, well, the other one's never going to come. We might as well put this one out. I don't blame them. I probably would have done the same thing. Because I've got something, you know, might as well put it out.
That was me talking with Mick Jagger, including the sound of Mick Jagger pouring me a glass of water. We're going to take a break, and we'll be back with more from Mick Jagger from the latest Rolling Stone cover story. We're playing some audio from my new cover story for Rolling Stone, which is on the Rolling Stones. And you can check out that cover story online at rollingstone.com or at newsstands in our print magazine. And so this next segment is, I started by asking Mick Jagger about Desert Trip, which he had just played with the Stones. Here we go.
What did you take away from Desert Trip and being among your generation and all that?
Dust. Fucking fucked my voice up for a week. I mean, it was like...
Oh, is that what it was?
Yeah.
Oh, shit. Okay.
Yeah, not only me. I mean, some of the audience... I went to my doctor in LA. He said, I've had 20 people in here have lost their voices. They're punters. I mean, I'm not, you know, I must have had something wrong, but I got over it now, but apart from that, it was kind of weird. I mean, it's just weird out in Palm Springs, in my opinion. I mean,
yeah.
I mean, it's a weird place. It's like super dry. It's the worst place to sing in the world.
Right, right, because
it's dusty and dry. I mean, and everyone knows that, and you know, I try to get around that, but I don't, yeah, man, you have to sing wherever you're booked, you know, if you agree to go. But I mean, I think the audience had a great time. I mean, I never got really a lot of feedback from the audience. I mean, I've never looked at a lot of postings. What did they like? It was very large, and it went on and on and on. And the stage was kind of bare, but it looks, and this video looks really big from where you are. But I mean, it doesn't look very big from. I'm not sure if they have video screens all the way back. And you weren't there, right?
Yeah, I was not. But from I've watched some YouTubes. The video screens were so huge that I think it worked.
I hope they could see. You know, it was like... But, you know, because my thing in doing these festivals is that the normally, you know, you get a bowl. So it's go, you know, Glastonbury, it's up, you know, right. It's up on a hill. So if you've that many people, which, you know... Glastonbury can be, you know, I can be 18 plus, but maybe it goes up on a hill. So you kind of get the idea that you're there, you know, you've got some height. But when it's just flat, I really worry about how much the people can see. That's not, I mean, and for the performer, I can't see them. It's just it's just a flat thing and I can see, how far can I see? It's just people. Right. And you kind of, as a performer, you're kind of like, you don't really know if you're communicating with them or not. It's easy to play in stadium. It's like this, you know, you can get 80,000 in a bowl. I played many of them.
Yeah.
But you get the feeling. I can see those people.
Right.
I know they're a long way away.
Right.
And I know I'm like an ant. Right. But
not this. Yeah, I understand.
I can see them waving.
Yeah.
However far they are away, I know. If I say everyone at the top wave and they wave.
Yeah.
I can see them.
Right.
I'm not criticizing the gig. I'm sure people had a great time.
Yeah.
But just I have no idea if I'm communicating with these people, you know, and And so, you know, that was my kind of feeling on the stage.
You had that line about never shared a stage with a Nobel Prize winner before. It is incredible. I mean, what do you make of that? I mean, like, it's quite controversial, too.
It had been mooted before, though, many times. It wasn't the first time that had ever been thought about.
And I'd read about, you know, would they give Bob Dylan the, you know, and the Nobel Prize of Literature, and there'd been a lot of discussion about whether it'd be right or not. I mean, endlessly.
Right.
And a lot of literary people thought it was perfectly good. I mean, Salman Rushdie, who I know quite well, I think he talked about it before.
Yes.
I think he was a sponsor, if you want, not in any kind of official sense, but
sure, he's pushing for it. Yeah.
But he's like putting it out there that he thinks it's a good idea, and I think it's wonderful.
Yeah. So I think the way Jan sees, and I totally understand this, is sort of it's shared by the whole sort of ethos of everyone, you know.
Yeah. I mean, it doesn't mean that every bad songwriter is going to get stay. Wait a minute, where's my fucking...
Larry, come on. The moon in June. That was great, my lines. One.
But I mean, he's worked... You know, he's got a huge body of work, and a lot of it's brilliant. And he's still going, and it's some of the best poetry that actual people know, if you know what I mean,
right?
Because it's out there and in various forms, and people know it in their hearts, and so I think it's very wonderful on that level and deserved.
Do you ever think about whether people will be 50 years from now, 100 years from now, there might be people listening to the Stones? Do you assume so?
No. To people, listen to musical songs from the 1910s. You know, there's always one or two that dig them up.
You don't care, do you?
How can I? What's the point? What's the point? It's like pop music for posterity is like a kind of oxymoron. Mm. You know, pop music is for now. Yeah. Pop music. That's why
you've made now lasted off for fucking long time.
Well, yeah, but that's good. That, I can claim that.
Yeah.
That's great. That's why I was worrying about the blues album.
Right.
It, you know what I'm saying? So pop music, I know it's not really pop music, but when those blues records came out, they were in a sense for that group, for that audience, they were pop music as if it was pop music. They would sing it, they would play it as if it was our, like we would play Kendrick Lamar. It was for them that. So it's all pop music. To me, it's all pop music without taking away all the genres,
sure,
for a minute, and it's all pop music. So that's what I'm saying to the record company. Can you make this pop music? If you want, is what I'm saying, because it's not per se at the moment pop music. It was once pop music.
Sure.
And as we said, Little Red Rooster was number one. You know, I mean, that was a weirdo thing, because we could have done anything at that point, would have been number one. That was the point.
Right.
But so, you know, I'm saying for a minute, you know, is it going to expand that just a few people buy it that will buy, you know, a blues record, you know, that would be pleased, or is it going to be further? And I don't know how we started this conversation. But anyway, pop music is very transient. So, right, you know, we're not making it for posterity. If some of these songs whoever, Bob Dylan or like Rolling Stone or lasts for a long time, then that's great. But that's not why I'm writing it. It might be like Bob Dylan may have thought of this more than I suspect he thinks of it more than I do.
Yeah. Well, then again, he hasn't gotten back to the committee, so I'm not sure what he's thinking.
Well, but he's not very communicative.
Did you? I guess Roger Daltrey came away from Desert Trip in a pensive mood and said that he thinks that rock and roll is not based on the festival, but just in general, has hit a dead end, and that it's kind of...
Well, people have been saying that for years.
Yeah.
And I did read his quote on that one. I don't know why he's... I mean, I like Roger very much, and, you know, he's a great guy and he's done a lot of wonderful things. But, I mean, I don't know why he suddenly would come out with that, because that's pretty obvious. I mean, that's an old group. And this is what I said to the promoter, you know, when he came to see me, he's a very nice guy. And he said, this is my idea for the show. And I said, you've got a lot of old, over 70 white English people playing all the same music. I mean, that's, I said to me, that's not like a festival. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because to me, a festival is, I want to hear something that I've never heard of. You know, yeah. Is there some kind of music that, wow, I never heard this rap from, you know, Mali. I never heard them play it live, you know, whatever. But, you know, I want to discover something and have a good time. But no, that wasn't obviously the point of this. The point of this was to put these kind of legendary acts all in one weekend. That was the point. But it so happens they all happen to be nearly all English, only one American. Neil Young's Canadian.
Dude, it does seem, I mean, you know, that there's, you know, and there's no reason, you don't know the answer, but I'm just curious what you think of the answer is, you know, since Nirvana, I think people have been waiting for, oh, what's the next thing with guitars that's going to change the world? And it really hasn't happened. It may, and maybe there's...
No, I know. You never know. I mean, were Nirvana that different? I mean, were they a different band? I mean, were they a different rock band or just a good rock band? I mean, the Kings of Leon new record was number one for a couple of weeks on iTunes. I mean, you know, it's just a success.
Yeah, sure.
You know, it's not nothing. I mean, if you think about it from a commercial point of view, you know, you need that song that people are going to like, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, there's one on the... there's one on the Kings of Leon album which is really catchy, you know, that's a pop song. It is a pop song, but I'm not sure if it's like the right mix of the pop song.
Yeah, for 2016 pop song.
You know what I'm saying?
Yes, yeah, I know exactly.
It's still a perfectly good pop song if you give it to someone to make into one, I think. Anyways, but that's sort of, you know, that's something else. But I mean, it was number one for a couple of weeks, and I think Kings of Leon are really great at people, and it's a pretty genuine rock band, and it's popular. I mean, so I don't think rock music is dead. I mean, I take Roger's point. It's not rock music. It's not at the cutting edge of pop anymore.
Sure, yeah.
Now we're going to hear from Keith Richards about the new blues album, Blue and Lonesome, and some other topics. Here's Keith Richards.
You said Muddy was like a father to you at some point. I mean, what kind of conversations did you have over the years? What kind of...
Even though it was just like he took you under the wing. No, I mean, no deep conversations. Conversations, sit down with the guitar together, and I try and play him my version of his stuff.
Yeah.
You know, or just, as I always wanted to be, second guitar, second stringer. Yeah, when I was a kid, I was in the second guitar behind Chuck Berry.
Right.
Or behind Elvis.
Yeah.
If I could join the Crickets, I would have joined. I didn't want to I wanted to be just part of it.
Yeah.
And Muddy made you felt you're really part of it, you know. He sort of brought you in. Great, I mean, large heart, you know. Not the only one. Howlin' Wolf is very much the same. I mean, a giant of a man, a most, formidable creature to actually face.
Yeah.
They sit around and talk with him, play. Oh, man, look, you know that lick? You know, and you just get into what you do, you know, and without any side on it. Well, I didn't know white guys could play like that. There was nothing, none of that.
Yeah.
You know, it was just, we connect. Yeah. And not particularly impressed about what color you happen to turn out to be or whatever. Although, of course, Muddy and other guys did recognize it for some reason. I mean, the Stones had brought back to America. And repopularized it. Or actually not so much popularized it as just brought it to attention.
Yeah.
Again, you know. And And for that, I'm eternally proud. It's probably the only way I'm going to get in heaven.
I mean, it must have been quite a thing to be... You had these guys whose album covers you were staring at, it, and then to step into those album covers and sing
it's the nuttiest
album.
Thing in the world. Yeah. It's like you stepped into a dream, in a way, you know? Never got out. I never woke up again.
Never woke up. You said that, you know, you would always say, you know, someday... Years and years ago, you say, "Oh, you know, someday we'll make a blues album, and we'll play blues on, you know, we'll sit in stools on stage like Muddy Waters and play the blues." You're not sitting down.
No, you might be getting gross. Yeah.
I mean, it's you know, Mick, you know, I you said as early as 1980, you said, you know, Mick doesn't have to run around so much; he could just stand at the microphone and sing. But he doesn't. To him.
No,
the Stones requires the running. You know,
the stages kept getting bigger and bigger.
Yes.
You know? Yeah. I mean, that was in 1980. I said that you're still playing every year after that. No, actually, throughout the 70s has actually occurred, and also on top of, I mean, I've. Mick Jagger could play this coffee table better than anybody I know because that was the size of our stages in those days.
Right.
You know? And he could still move it. And, you know, he had the thing with the maracas.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, the man is a natural mover.
Yeah.
What is more natural for a front man than you give him more room than him to use the room? Yeah, I've seen especially as athletic as Mick is, and also you feel the need to reach out. Suddenly it's a football stadium or something even bigger and sometimes, you know, I mean, where you feel the need to get out there and like, so they're not...
Yes, they're a little closer, yeah.
And there's two ways of doing that. I think Bob proved the other way of doing it, actually, at Coachella, where he would bring the stage down to his comfort level, his size.
Right.
Bob is not going to start doing the splits and running around.
Yeah.
But at the same time, to concentrate everybody's thing and to... enormous stage there at Coachella, and Bob managed to turn it into his area. And that's what I mean about performance. Some feel the need to use the room, others can bring you into their space.
Well, could there be a version of the Stones when Mick doesn't want to run? Because he was wondering out loud how long he can keep.
I've been thinking about this. Yeah. Someday you ain't going to be a runner. But over the years, I've probably been on the push and say, just because you have all that room doesn't mean you have to use it. But then there's a natural energy in the man, and the man is the one who's got to sing, you know, which is in with this blues record. You know, whatever track is on it, it's because Mick said, oh, that Lightning Slim on it. The singer has got the wanna.
Yeah.
You know, it's no point in somebody from behind saying, oh, you should sing this one, and you don't feel like it. He'll do it. But you right. won't get the essence of it because there'd be an imposition, so as to speak. So if I catch a lead man that says, I want to do this, this is the one I want to do, which is like Stone set list. Mick, write the list.
Right.
The ones you want to sing. You know, I might change the order here and there because of technical things like, you know, guitars and the changes and whatever. Very rarely. To me, the important thing is that you go on there with a guy that says, this is what I want to do tonight.
Yeah.
And and that energy, that extra confidence is what, to me, counts. You know.
You let him, you let his energy guide it. But I mean, but you, it feels like if 85 to 89 was World War III, you've called it, between the two of you guys, and then maybe you had World
War
IV.
Rough, that was a pretty rough period. Yeah.
And then it seems like you just maybe had World War IV for a while, but before this rapprochement. But it does feel, just from the outside, that maybe there really has been a thawing, that maybe that you guys are getting along better than in a long time. Is that...
I don't know how to explain this. Mick and I mean, I love the man. It doesn't mean I can't get pissed off occasionally. And I've no doubt, without a doubt, it's the other way around. But when you're working together, like that, I mean, sometimes you have to forgive and forget. And also, I would say that 89% of the time, we're in total agreement.
Mm. Mm. 89, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I chose that number in particular. But people only hear about that 11%, this is where it flares up, what would the Stones be without it? When did anybody have the perfect machine? Everybody in total agreement. It was there. It'd probably be fairly bland.
Right. No push and pull, yeah.
No. Yeah. I mean, and so I think by now, at least I do, and I think Mick pretty much says that now and again we're going to bitch. But, when it does, it's going to hit the headlines. But that was not the point, it'd be that they're arguing. I'll make up people are walking around with shrouds. And it's just another tiff. I've known the man longer than actually just about any man I've known. The face of the planet, 4 or 5 years old. I don't know many other people that age, our age, that I've known, and especially worked with, and such, intense ways, and gone through so much, created a career of it's amazing we're both alive. I celebrate Nick's life, and he's always 5 months older than me.
And now I have with me from Rolling Stone, Patrick Doyle and Andy Green. And we are going to be talking a little bit more about the Rolling Stones, because what else is there really to talk about in the world? So guys, this album Blue and Lonesome that's coming out, it came out of sessions for what is supposed to be the first Rolling Stone original album since 2005. Now, do you guys think that this album, the original album, is ever going to come out?
No.
Mm-mm.
It's been 19 years and a single studio album. They seem incapable of doing it. It's not going to happen, I think.
Yeah. They overthink it, I think, when it's their own material. They spend way too much time on it. This was a 3-day album, and it it's the best thing they've done in 30 years, so...
Wow. Okay. So, I think it's very good. Do you think it is truly the best thing they've done in 30 years? So tell me which album 30 years ago you're saying is the best since.
I think Dirty Work is a great album.
Dirty Work. Okay.
No,
you're supposed to say the best since Some Girls. The official line is always the best since Some Girls.
Right.
Okay, you're saying the best since Dirty Work. Okay.
I'm a big Keith fan, and Dirty Work is basically a Keith album with Mick singing. So that's why I like it. But I actually really like Bridges to Babylon too. If they were to make an album like that, where it's a complete opposite direction. It's not trying to be commercial exactly, but just trying to do something different, then I'd be interested to hear it.
Right, but there's no incentive really, because the money is all in touring. An album is a huge pain. It's just gonna sell three copies and just be criticized. I just see no incentive just to work so hard on something. That's just not, that'll be a fight the entire time.
Mm-hmm. It's a nice bookend to the end of their career, too. This is just perfect, I think.
Yes.
So you're suggesting they just walk off?
No.
Very
they should
nice
keep
boundary.
Touring. I would love to hear a new album. I just think it's very unlikely. Whereas they are a touring band, essentially. You know, that's what they've mm-hmm. been for a very long time. That's the core of what the Stones are, is a concert experience.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the problems is that whenever there's a long gap between albums, you get into a little bit of Chinese Democracy syndrome. Not that they've been working on an album the way that Axl did, but you get into that syndrome of, oh my God, this better be killer, you know? And I think that tends to be, as we all know from our own creative endeavors, the longer you wait, the more it becomes, oh my God, I have to kill this. This is late, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's a trap.
Yeah, and there's a songwriting team that has not really worked together as a true team in a long time. That's a problem, too.
I think with the Bigger Bang, they got together for 2 weeks at Mick's house and wrote songs. And I think that album is better than a lot of people say, but I don't see them doing that at 75 years old.
Yeah, it's too bad. I wish they would, like, release four albums in the next 4 years. Like, just take advantage of their working relationship, right, such as it is, and just put stuff out, and that way it takes the pressure off, you know. But I don't think that's gonna happen.
No, and with these box sets, you can just think of all the attention they got for Exile on Main Street. That was more attention than a Bigger Bang got. You know, they have so much history they can mine that it's just easier.
So what did you guys take away from listening to Blue and Lonesome, the Stones' new blues album?
I think it's great. I like hearing. I think Ronnie is amazing on this album, because he's really kind of stepped up on tour. You know, as Keith has had problems with arthritis and other things, it's I think he has stepped up and really become an amazing real lead guitar. It's become more of a lead rhythm situation as opposed to switching off, I think. And so I think Ronnie is amazing, and Keith is also has this laid back style that he didn't have 15, even 20 years ago. I think that he is it's almost like Chuck Berry got later in age, with where you can hear the struggle to play, but Keith has a certain soul that he brings to it that it's great.
Right. It's a very nice reminder also that there's still a band there. Because the concert with the horns and the keyboards and the backup singers, you know, it feels a bit Vegas-y at times, where this is just the core band playing and they sound fantastic.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can really feel. There's points when you literally can't tell whether it's 2016 or, you know, 1970. I really think that.
Right.
You know, and maybe I'm deluded, but I really
No, I think
do
you're right.
That.
And it's a tribute to Mick's incredible voice and Charlie's stamina and skill. I mean, it's incredible. In their mid-70s, they're still able to pull this off.
Yeah, and Ron and Keith's weaving, as they call it, they really do play incredibly well together.
Yeah, and Mick's harmonica playing, which you touched on in your story, it's just so good on this album.
Yeah, we played a lot of Mick talking about harmonica earlier. This is the most harmonica talk that's ever been on SiriusXM, I think.
Yeah, and it's so perfect that they've gone full circle. This is back to their very, very roots, and it's just stellar, I think.
So, one of the things I asked the Stones is, you know, how long can this go on? How long can this go on? You know, it's they had their 50th anniversary, and then they just kept going. I think it's incredible.
Yeah, I think that Mick is a freak of nature. There's no reason why they can't do it like another 6-7 years. I just think Charlie's the problem. I know that he's a very light touch, but when he's 81 years old, is he going to want to play 2-hour concerts? And if he leaves, do they carry on? That's always a big question of, like,
right.
Is there
and
a band?
Of course, I asked Keith that, and he said that Charlie Watts will never die. I won't allow it. And then I added or retire, and he's like, yeah, or retire. So that's how
right. But he might do one of those two things, and it'll put him in a very tough spot.
But no, Andy, Keith said he won't allow
right.
it. I don't understand.
No, I know that he has superpowers, but maybe, you know, he can't stop death or retirement.
Keith also, by the way, Keith did also tell me that I confessed the interview took place, you know, maybe a week before the election, and I confessed that I was getting concerned about the polls and that Trump might win, and Keith said, oh, don't worry about it, he'll fuck it all up, which unfortunately was also not true, and you know, maybe he meant, you know, he'll fuck it up after the election, I don't know, but unfortunately, as Keith has a habit of saying, he is not a Nostradamus, so.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, Patrick, you were asking me earlier via email what I took away from... Yeah.
I was curious, just listening. It was really interesting to hear the audio of it because Mick kind of puts you in a trance almost. It's a really interesting... I loved hearing him talk. I've never heard him be that kind of open before because he's notoriously kind of hates doing interviews and he's pretty shy and closed off. And it was really interesting to hear. I was just curious what you kind of... we've listened to the Stones a ton and talk about them at the office all the time, but what did you take away from spending extended amount of time with both of those guys for the story?
Well, yeah, I'm going to wrap up in a second, but, I found the Stones incredibly charming. The other reason why they've been so successful is because they are so deeply, incredibly charming, and I think they're in a really great place, and they really do convince you that the Rolling Stones will last forever. So in this episode, we talked, we played some audio from Mick Jagger and Keith Richards from the new Rolling Stone cover story. And this has been Rolling Stone Music Now. Download our podcast at rollingstone.com/podcast or wherever you get your podcasts. And we'll see you next week on Friday on Sirius XM.